is Jerd.
This is Jumble Day, the battle of ideas.
Yeah. Have you been to my side of the pond? Or have you been to the African continent?
No.
You really should. It's a different experience altogether. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, I think I would like to go there. I certainly wouldn't want to go to Israel. I'll definitely would love to go to Africa.
I love how you just inserted that.
Yeah, well.
Michael Rechtenwald, I was just saying to you now before we began recording, you were on my podcast about 5 years ago, just as the madness began. Would you go back to 2019 if you could?
2019, that's when I retired from NYU. But it was 2016 when the real fireworks began over there with the, when I did an interview with the student newspaper about the social justice or what now is called woke excesses, as it were. And that started my, acceleration to leave NYU, which happened by 2019. I sued NYU, for libel and defamation of several professors who libeled and basically defamed me on email to the whole NYU list. This was
what happened
with the lawsuit. We settled. So
okay.
Wikipedia says that it was dismissed, but that's not true. They settled with me. I got a cash settlement, and I had I basically retired in good standing, and I still have access. I got all the retirement benefits, including health care, and also access to all of NYU's electronic stuff. So I'm still effectively like a retired faculty member from NYU.
Your timing was good, though, because if you had stayed into 2020, they would have had a really good excuse to get rid of you.
Oh, yeah, because they would have tried to force the vaccine on me. They would have made me abide by the mask mandates, and I wouldn't have done it. So it came early enough that I got out of there before COVID, thank goodness, because New York was a hellhole at that time, and it is now again as well. But, that whole history is kind of I've basically rehearsed that hundreds of times. What happened? I criticized social justice on in an interview, and they forced me into a leave of absence, removed me from campus. This was all just for criticizing the excesses of social justice activism and policy on campus.
And you know it's bad when somebody like Andrew Doyle, who's gay, has to criticize it.
That's true. Or Milo Yiannopoulos, for that matter.
Oh, yes. You know, I kind of look back to that late 20 teens with great fondness. It was a good era of culture wars.
Yes, it was. And that's what really precipitated NYU to settle with me, is when I invited Milo into one of my classes to speak on Halloween. And the mayor of New York supposedly shut down my classroom. My classroom with 14 students, because they said it was a danger to the community. So that's how NYU got around violating my academic freedom, which is just a complete misnomer. There is no such thing.
What do you think's happened to academia?
It's been subverted, and it's been under, for the most part, there are certain schools or certain certain disciplines that haven't been too badly affected. Some of the sciences have been exempt from a lot of this, but it's just been nothing but a social justice crusade that began probably in the 1920s and just accelerated when Trump ran for office. That's when it really became intolerable, because the campuses started to throw, you know, cancel speakers, institute bias reporting hotlines, institute safe spaces, and so on and so forth, and made, you know, tried to make me put a bias reporting hotline number on my syllabus, which I refused to do.
I'm trying to think how far back this nonsense goes. I mean, I know in the 80s, they sort of invented the idea that black people can't be racist. What do they call it? Critical theory,
critical race theory.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't remember the term transgender ever being used up until what, the late 20 teens or something.
Well, yeah, I think it was, you basically referred to people as transvestites before
yes.
that. And then the transgender movement, which is funded by billionaires, okay? They funded this movement in order to, I think, subvert the family. The idea there, if you don't have man and woman, you don't have husband and wife. And without husband and wife, you don't have husband, wife, and child. So you get rid of the family unit. Of course, that was one of the 10 prongs of the Communist Manifesto, abolition of the family. They just did it by different means.
Yes, it's funny you mention that because you were a Marxist for the longest time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then whenever they came after me and I realized what a totalitarian ideology it was and how if you crush individual rights, you have nothing. There's no collective well-being or collective good or common good when individuals and their rights are destroyed. So I became a libertarian almost overnight. And then I started to get into libertarian theory, and I became, you know, I was a civil libertarian at first, let's put it that way. And then I became a full-fledged economic, political libertarian. And by the way, I ran for president as a, you know, I ran to for the nomination of the Libertarian Party, which I almost won. I won five times. But I won five times, but you have to reach 50%. And then, you know, somebody threw their support to another guy at the very end when he had promised to support me for 6 months. So I was basically sold out. I think Trump had something to do with it because Trump could not afford to lose any right-leaning votes. And what they did, I was a right-leaning libertarian or right libertarian. And they didn't want me in the race. So I believe they paid off this guy to throw his support to this guy, Chase Oliver, who is basically nothing but a Trojan horse for LGBTQIA++ activism. That's all he did after he won, was go to pride parades. So that's what they think libertarianism is, the freedom to cut off your penis, you know. That's basically what it comes down to for these people.
What is libertarianism?
Well, it is, for me, it is the first principle is the non-aggression principle, naturally. That is, you cannot aggress against somebody's person or property. The second principle for me is basically, it's anti-statism. The state is the biggest enemy to liberty.
I've flirted with various aspects, I suppose, of libertarianism for, I don't know, a decade or more. I mean, I've read Rothbard and Mises and Hayek, and I think my gateway was Milton Friedman.
drug, yeah. The real terminus... The real terminus of this line of thinking from Mises to Rothbard is Hans Hermann Hoppe.
Oh, yes, he's great. Democracy, yeah. The God That Failed.
Yes, excellent book. And I thought his analyses of certain things are incredibly good. He revised the whole theory of class warfare, class struggle, by the way, and said, you know, Marx was right. The history of humanity is the history of class struggle. But the ruling class is not the capitalist class per se. It is the state and all of its beneficiaries. And I think that's absolutely true. If it wasn't for the state, you couldn't have the kind of monopolies that we have, the kind of crony capitalism that we have. We don't have capitalism at all. We don't have freedom, free markets. We have state-controlled profiteering, effectively.
Well, Hans Hermannhop pretty much converted me away from democracy to monarchy. The thing with monarchy is that it's, as he argues, it's the ultimate private property.
Yeah, that's correct. The state itself becomes private property, owned by the king or queen. And also, the time preference of monarchs is much lower than that of the, you know, democratically elected or installed figures. In the case of democracy, you get people in there that have a very high time preference, and they don't care about spending money. They don't care about long-term projects because their term is short, so they're going to benefit themselves and their buddies as quickly as possible and pillage the state and the resources for their friends, which hopefully brings us to the main topic here.
Well, I mean, yes, I was kind of segueing towards what happened in 2020, because this was pretty much the event that, well, other than that World War II event that we aren't allowed to speak about, 2020 was pretty much the event that redefined the modern era.
Yeah. Yeah, the COVID crisis, which was a elite-driven superimposition of tyranny on the pretext of a global health crisis, which they started.
Yeah.
So, in other words, you can count on them to create the problem, then cause the the response, like, we're all afraid, and then come along with the solution. This is the Hegelian dialectic in operation. Then come along with the solution, which is always worse than the problem. And the solution was, you know, a totalitarian lockdown state with, you know, with surveillance and what have you. And it's gotten worse even after COVID, I think so.
COVID was an interesting era, though. I mean, I don't think it's over. I think it was a placeholder in many ways. But it certainly forced a lot of people to rethink everything they think they know about everything.
Yes, I think that's true. People started to realize a couple things. One is there's a class of people that want us dead or utterly in chains, in effect. And then that the state is not your friend, it's actually your enemy. And that a good deal of the population will go along with this and become sentinels of the state, becoming sentinels of surveillance, and they will become agents of the state. In fact, they will be part of what Havel called post-totalitarianism, Vaclav Havel.
One of my guests, she spent, the greater part of the last 6 years looking into the hospital data just off New York. And she started out by trying to figure out, you know, what was going on, as we were all trying to figure out at the time. And she said to me, I started out looking at New York's hospital data, and I ended up questioning whether we landed on the moon.
Once you go down these rabbit holes, a lot of things start to come under scrutiny, of course, and you become skeptical of all the official narratives. And I think the best demarcation device is this: if the official narrative, whatever the official narrative is, your best bet is to say that the opposite is true, because effectively they're always pushing the inverse of truth.
Who's it now that referred to it as a cathedral? I'm thinking I've gone blank. He refers to government plus Mencius, media plus...
Mencius Goldbug.
Yeah. Mencius Goldbug. There we go. What's his real name? Yeah, so I was reading that Dark Enlightenment stuff many years ago. Basically, the establishment would be the government plus media plus academia.
Yeah, that's right.
Although, yeah.
Curtis Yarvin is his name.
Curtis Yarvin, thank you.
Yeah, Curtis Yarvin. The cathedral is the academia, he calls like the cathedral. It is the, you know, postmodern equivalent of the papacy, of the, you know, or papacy, however you want to say it. The academics are effectively, you know, what they do is issue statements that are treated ex cathedra. They are treated like, you know, papal edicts, as it were. And then the media is kind of like the, intermediary between academia and the unwashed, as it were, the public. And they, you know, they metastasize the cathedral's findings and holdings to the broader public.
But I mean, that's very true. I mean, look how people metaphorically worshipped Fauci. You know, he would go on TV and say safe and effective, and they would throw out these catchphrases, and people would just repeat them like it was a cult.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people just bought into it entirely, and then they coined this thing called the science, which was the opposite of science, because science is open inquiry and debate and contestation. But they wanted to eliminate that and say science is, well, what did Fauci say? I am science, he said. I am science. Unbelievable. Nothing like that has ever happened in the history of science. And I am a historian of science, and I can tell you that that's a first. I am science.
I mean, just for clarity, what is science?
Science is the experimental testing of empirical data, or the derivative, deriving of empirical data to approach truth. But it never reaches it wholly. It is always asymptotic. It's always approaching but never reaching. So science is always, the findings of science are always provisional, because further investigations and explorations and discoveries can always change the findings and therefore the conclusions that science draws. So science is an asymptotic approach to truth. Let's say that. I think I'll coin that. Science is the asymptotic approach to truth.
But I mean, this is precisely what the Great Reset's all about, or Agenda 20, or Build Back Better, or whatever the catchphrases are, that they all mean the same thing. It's about replacing critical thinking with sort of a cult-like dogmatic approach to the science. And if you question it, you're a science denier.
Yeah, and climate science is the big one. I think that the COVID thing was like a test run to see how people would respond to climate lockdowns and climate curtailment of freedoms, like freedom of mobility. And of course, all of this is being introduced and executed at the local level, where it has to be in order to function. And so you're seeing cities in the United States and elsewhere, I'm sure in Great Britain, I don't know about Africa, but where they're basically moving toward the 15-minute city model, where you're supposed to not go outside the periphery of this 15 minutes city, where you can get to by public transportation, bicycle, or walking within 15 minutes. And they're trying to restrict automobile traffic. They've ruined the streets in this city where I live, Pittsburgh, by making all these bike lanes where nobody rides bikes, trying to make it more difficult to drive. And, you know, in Great Britain, they have zones where you can't drive, you know, at all at certain times. I forget exactly the details, but they restrict driving in particular zones in the UK, like in London and so forth. So Agenda 2030, the Great Reset, they're effectively the same thing. It is the Great Reset is merely the World Economic Forum's implementation is the word I'm looking for, implementation of Agenda 2030 through corporate stakeholder capitalism.
Yeah, there we go. That's the hook, because people get caught up in that false dichotomy of, well, it's either communist or it's capitalist. But that's the beauty of the technocratic system. It merges the state and private companies.
Yes, it's economic fascism. And that's what stakeholder capitalism is. It is this idea that corporations will do the work that states were unable or unwilling to do. And that is, it will, using the ESG scores, whatever they're calling it now, it will restrict certain production so as to restrict certain consumption along the lines according to, you know, these green imperatives. And it's also a monopoly scheme for these corporations because they drive out all competitors this way. If you don't, and it's all done through basically BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, and all those. Yeah, and those three top asset managers who basically determine who gets, you know, whose stocks are going to be purchased, who's going to get capital infusions. And if they don't abide by the ESG, they're going to lose capital infusions. And of course, now Larry Fink is not only the CEO of BlackRock, he's also now the chair of the World Economic Forum. I mean, we already knew he was running
it.
I mean,
this is coincidence. This is coincidence.
He's officially running it now. It's unbelievable. So I argued, you know, way back that actually Larry Fink was the operative driving figure because he was on the board of the WEF, but now he's the chairman. So that BlackRock is really the driving force of the Great Reset.
And I mean, speaking of wolves in sheep's clothing, this is what World Economic Forum and NGOs are in many ways, because people look at them as these innocent structures.
Yeah, they're supposedly humanitarian or, you know, environmentalists or, you know, immigration friendly and all that, but they're actually accelerating the imposition of the technocratic state, which will be in the United States and probably everywhere else under a Palantir panopticon, which confuses AI and facial recognition and a number of other, I don't know what else, all the technologies that go into Palantir, but Palantir is the big panopticon that's being erected.
Well, I mean, Palantir is a great example of state capitalism or stakeholder capitalism.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a public-private partnership. I mean, they're a private company that work hand in hand with the state.
Yes, they got their big contracts from the state. Trump handed them one early in his the second term here, and now they're actually getting most of their money from the state and also from Israel. They also used the Palantir in Gaza. And that's part of the way they use the facial recognition AI and so forth to locate people and to imprison and so forth and kill them. So
this is precisely the end game, though.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the end game is you own nothing and be happy, and you'll be under total surveillance. Mm. Your speech rights will be curtailed. You may not even your thought rights. Really, we should start talking about thought rights because.
Well, I mean, Yuval Harari said that. He said that humans will become hackable.
Yes, totally hackable beings. There is no such thing as free will. He said it's a complete myth. And we can hack you at any, you can be hacked. And they could take over your brain. This is what I wrote about in my novel, Thought Criminal. I don't know if you've seen that, but the premise, the premise there is that they use nanobots to take over the neocortex, which is not.
I like how you call it a novel.
Because I called it a novel because I didn't want it to be called conspiracy theory. That's it.
It's like calling The Matrix a movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I called it a novel because I didn't want to be dubbed. I was trying to find ways to fight back against the COVID regime and trying to counter the propaganda and essays and stuff like that. But I found that the best way to get some of these things across is actually through analogy, which fiction really is. It's analogy. Like, this is to the present as that is to the present in the novel. So it allows people to extrapolate much more easily about what's happening now.
Yeah, but I mean, the term conspiracy theorist is kind of like being called a racist or a homophobe or whatever. It's a label that has lost its meaning. Conspiracy, I mean, most people don't know how it was weaponized by the CIA back after the JFK assassination. Yeah,
the CIA weaponized it, but you know who really started this whole poo-pooing of conspiracy theory was Karl Popper in his book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, in 1944. And he called it the conspiracy theory of society, which was a straw man because he suggested that conspiracy theories claim that all events can be attributed to conspiracies by conspirators. But nobody that's a conspiracy theorist, so-called, is saying all events are determined. They're just saying that there are conspiracies, and there are. And a conspiracy theorist is somebody that theorizes about a conspiracy, so it's a real weaponized term used to dismiss people. And I've written an essay called "The Epistemological Status of Conspiracy Theory." Epistemologically, a conspiracy theory should not be discounted automatically for being a conspiracy theory. Period.
But I mean, if you just think about it for 10 seconds, it's so stupid because when someone says, "I'm not a conspiracy theorist," right? I mean, what are they saying? Did JFK just happen to coincidentally be in a car when there were stray bullets flying around? Or did Julius Caesar just happen to fall on a bunch of knives? I mean, it's so Monty Python-esque in its stupidity.
Yeah, it's absurd because conspiracies are not only exist, but they're prevalent. And a conspiracy is just one, two or more people. A bank robbery is a conspiracy. Okay.
Yeah.
You conspire with a couple other people or more to rob a bank. And the conspiracy theory is to try to find out who did it. That's all. It's simple.
I mean, COVID was a conspiracy. Explain to me how the whole world just coincidentally started locking down countries in March 2020.
All at the same time, with the exact same mechanisms.
Language.
All at the same. Yeah. I mean, there was very few exceptions. I think Sweden was one. Or was it Switzerland? I forget. But anyway, yeah, it seems like COVID is like a nightmare that I not remember all the details of at this juncture, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking back to when the lockdowns began. They were March 2020, and I remember thinking, I have never in my life heard the term social distancing. Had you heard the term before?
Never before. And the funny thing is, I mocked it early on. I was in a grocery store when they started using that term, and I said, oh, I better not get too close, you know, social distancing to a person. And they did not laugh because they were taking it very seriously, social distancing. I mean, that's a loaded term, suggestive of the idea that they want to isolate you from other people. And then it was the ad council that ran an ad called Alone Together. Okay.
I remember.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's crazy.
There's a subtle segue here, Michael, because I remember questioning what was going on early on. I had David Icke on my podcast. I think it was April 2020, and immediately it got taken down from YouTube, obviously. And I know that you're an advocate for free speech.
Yes.
What do you mean, though, by that? When you say free speech, what do you mean?
It's the ownership. So since I own myself, okay, self-ownership, this is a libertarian principle. Since I own myself, I have the right to do with myself what I will, short of violating somebody else's rights. And so free speech is using your self-ownership to utter things or write things or otherwise communicate things using your own body and mind.
I ask that because I, for many years, have had an internal tug of war with the idea of free speech and what it means. For example, I don't like people talking on their cell phone in a cinema, and I'm okay with their speech being curtailed so that I can listen to the movie.
Yeah, that's a context, you know. Like, so, say you go into a private room. Okay, so in a private space, the owner of the space has the right to determine what's allowed. Like, I'm not going to have you in my house if you're like an Antifa member and want to burn down the place or otherwise, you know, say all kinds of things. In other words, it's ownership that determines free speech rights. So a university that owns the space or controls the space, and owning really means having control over it, can impose certain restrictions in certain contexts, definitely. And that's a property rights issue.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where I was going, because then isn't the focus on free speech a misdirection? Shouldn't the focus be on property rights?
Yes, that's really what it comes down to. It's a property right issue. So in my property, or in non-owned property like public space, although, you know, that's another matter we could get into, but in my own property, I'm allowed to say whatever the hell I want, you know. And I can use my self-ownership to use myself, my mind, my body to utter whatever I particularly want to say. And as long as it's not a direct incitement, like a direct incitement to violence, like to broach other people, to breach other people's rights.
But then, you see, because this is why I'm saying I've got this tug of war, because then you have property rights occurring all around you. So your property becomes highly localized.
You have self-ownership. That's it. In your own property, you have free speech.
Which is why you want to reduce this. You want to reduce the state ownership of property. Then
that's where I was going.
Yeah,
you want to have all. That's why you want a private property society. And that's why Hans Hermann Hoppe said you could physically remove people who are in inimical to the private property society that you establish, because they don't have the free speech to start advocating for communism or the revocation of your property rights, so they can get thrown out. Thus the meme physical removal.
Property rights goes hand in hand with what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, Israel is violating the non-aggression principle constantly. They're encroaching upon the property rights of the Palestinians, not only their land, but their persons. And it's also, I think, a double NAP, non-aggression principle violation, because they're also extracting wealth from the United States citizens to do it. And that is also a property right infringement. So all taxes are improper, are infringements, but in this case, we're being extorted to pay for genocide.
You started a group called AZAPAC. Is that right? How do you say it?
AZAPAC. Yeah, it's the Anti-Zionist America PAC, first of its kind in the world, first of its kind in America for sure. First and only PAC that's explicitly anti-Zionist, and our objective is to remove Zionism from the U.S. government. It is not about ending Israel. It is not about from the river to the sea. We don't have any of those slogans. What we're saying is this: Zionism in the United States, in particular, is the bribery and blackmail of our political class and the extortion of taxpayers for Israel. That's all that matters to me. I don't care what Israel thinks it is. I don't care what other Zionists say it is, because that's what it means to us. We're being extorted for Israel. And then Israel is using that extorted money to slaughter people. That's why I find it so narrowly, so that we don't get into discussions about, well, that means you don't want the self-determination of Jewish people to have their own state. No, we're not saying that. We're not saying that Israel shouldn't exist. We're not saying that at all. What we're saying is, from the American standpoint, Zionism is extortion and blackmail and bribery.
I mean, ultimately, it doesn't matter if Jews want a homeland. I mean, Zulus can have a homeland. White people can have a homeland. Christians can have a homeland. I mean, it doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think people should be able to have self-determination. I think, you know, but they don't allow this. For example, in the United States, there's a group setting up a white community, white only. You have to be from European extraction. And they're being challenged by the ADL and all these other organizations for doing what Israel's doing there, which is to have their own. Now, Israel is not a real private property society at all in the first place. The Israel Land Authority, the Israeli Land Authority, owns most of the land and real estate in Israel, and they rent it to people. And you get it first on the basis of your Jewish affiliation, or I don't know what to call it, ethnicity, religio, ethnical background, however they define Jewish. I don't know, because to me, it's very nebulous.
Okay, so Michael, is Israel a proxy of the U.S., or is the U.S. a proxy of Israel?
That's a great question. This is cuts to the heart of the difference between my view and AZAPAC's view, and typically what leftist anti-Zionists say. They think that that Israel is just the proxy, or like a outpost of U.S. imperialism. I think quite the opposite, actually. The United States is the military industrial arm of Israel, and we are its. You mentioned the Matrix. The best metaphor I can think of is, we are the batteries in the Matrix, feeding that beast. And we don't get anything out of, for example, the imperialist wars that Israel would have us fight it at their behest. For example, the Iraq War. What did we get out of that? We got hundreds of thousands killed of U.S. soldiers. We got trillions of dollars worth of debt. And we got nothing but complete chaos and then also immigration. So they caused the immigration crisis through a lot of the immigration crisis through the displacement of people. And what did we get out of Afghanistan? The same thing, and it was done for Israel. I don't want to get into the details about why that is or how I could explain how it was for Israel, but it was. And then the bombing of Iran recently, and now the new threats to attack Iran right now. This is all for Israel. It doesn't benefit the U.S. at all. And certainly the extortion of the billions and billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars since October 7, 2023, from the United States to Israel. How does that benefit us? How does that benefit the United States that we sent them $33 billion since October 7th, 2023? It doesn't benefit us at all. In fact, it harms us tremendously. So I don't see the U.S. imperial regime, you know, the empire increasing at all. We're not increasing the U.S. empire. The whole plan is to increase Israel's empire and its greater Israel project and its other territorial and worldwide ambitions. I mean, look at the total imposition of in Europe. I don't know what it's like down in Africa, but I mean, it's almost illegal to protest Israel. In Germany, for example, you know, it's illegal basically to protest Israel. It's unbelievable. And in the United States, they're trying to make it illegal too. They made it illegal for college students effectively because they have equated using the IHRA definition, the International Holocaust Remembrance Association's definition of anti-Semitism, it is really illegal to criticize Israel or to say that they're racist or say they're like the Nazis or to say basically anything. And that's a working definition, which means they can change it and add to it at any time. And they do. Mm. So,
Well, Trump doesn't like my country very much because South Africa is the only country that attempted to take Israel to the international court, you might remember.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, it doesn't mean anything. It's just symbolic, I suppose, because nothing will come of it.
You mean of Trump's hatred for South America?
No. I mean the court case.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's true. I think the ICC has declared that, Netanyahu is a war criminal. The ICJ has said it's plausible, you know, probable genocide. I don't know exact terms, but it's, you know, basically genocide. The UN has basically said it's genocide, and nothing will happen because the United States, acting on Israel's behalf, will veto anything, any resolutions that would punish Israel at all, no matter what it does. It could blow up the whole Middle East with the nuclear bombs, and it won't matter.
That's what I don't understand, Michael. Why? Why is the U.S. Israel's bitch? How did this happen?
It's a long series of subversion starting, you know, at least as early as JFK, who I believe.
Yeah, he was kind of neutral. And then every president after that has been Zionist.
That's correct. Everybody after. He was less, I don't think he was neutral, actually, because he was trying to inspect the Dimona reactor, and he was trying to make what's now AIPAC, it was called something else then, register as a foreign agent, and then he was shot. So,
well, he also tried to dismantle the CIA, or he wanted to.
Yes. I think Mossad and the CIA collaborated to take him out.
I think that's a fair conclusion.
Right now, but, I mean, no,
I think that's pretty fair. Trump is one of the most intense Zionists of the recent U.S. president lineup.
Yes, the mask has come off. I wrote an essay, and it's up on the AZAPAC site, which, by the way, is aza-pac.com. We have an essay section, and I called have an essay called Zion Dawn, the completion of U.S. Zionization. And under Trump, we have seen a total accelerationism of Zionist Zionism in the United States policies and in the United States, you know, not only foreign policy, but domestic as well, domestic Zionism. So, you know, this, the writing was on the wall from the first administration with the Abraham Accords, with the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem, with saying
turning
that
Gaza into a holiday strip,
turning it into the Riviera of the Mediterranean, unbelievable. But even in the first administration, the posture towards Iran, the Abraham Accords, as I said, and the Golan Heights annexation ratification by the U.S., the no longer calling West Bank occupied territory, all of that. I mean, just unbelievable. There's some good essays out there on that. One is by Jose Nino. He talks about this. I don't remember the title, but if you look up Jose Nino on Substack, he's really good on this, and he's associated with our PAC.
Do you think there's a link between Greater Israel and the Great Reset?
That's a great question. I think so, because the link is the panopticon, you know, what they're trying to erect, the panopticon of total surveillance and control under a kind of Zionist dictatorship, you know. So I hadn't put these things together until, you know, maybe a year and a half ago, but I think that there is a definite connection. I think they're effectively going to fuse the two projects. Greater Israel is just the regional element of Zionism. It's not the whole of it, the regional element. The whole of Zionism is to control the governments of all the countries in the world. And that's pretty scary. But that's the conclusion I've drawn after quite a bit of consideration and research. Infiltrated all these governments. You know, it's illegal to criticize them almost anywhere in Europe. They're trying to, you know, the last bastion, once again, as always, is the United States, but we're under siege. Mm. We're under a Zionist siege right now.
I think it was Yuri Bezmenov who was a former KGB operative. He said in a great interview back in 1984, ironically, with G. Edward Griffin, he said that the U.S. He said the U.S. will destroy itself from within.
Yeah, that's right. Subversion. He talked about the way that subversion works. He didn't tie it to Zionism, but I think it's easily extrapolated, you know. Mm. Speaking of which, going back to Hoppe, you know, Hoppe said that in a private property society, you would eliminate inimical ideologies, or people that hold inimical ideologies would be physically removed. They would be requested to leave, and if they didn't, they would be physically removed. Well, Zionism is one of those. It is an ideology that is totalitarian. It means to infringe our rights tremendously. And it means to extort money from us. So it is one of these ideologies that would be physically removed.
A Jewish friend of mine said to him, Zionism is just simply the right to have a Jewish homeland.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. But the problem is what constitutes having a Jewish homeland happens to be, starting with, you know, the Nakba, and then further oppression and isolation and control of the Palestinian region and the Palestinians, constant onslaughts against them, and their infringement of their rights That's the whole thing. It started from terrorism. Haganah, Ergon, and the Stern Gang. They were terrorists. They conducted terrorism not only against Arabs, but against the British when they blew up the King David Hotel, killed all these British people, British ambassadors, all kind of stuff. So the whole project begins with the violation of other people's rights and continues on that basis. So in that sense, it's not true that it just means the right for Jewish people to have a homeland. I mean, they could have that homeland somewhere else that wouldn't infringe on other people's rights. Go buy an island. Go buy, they have the enclave in Russia, which was set aside for them. Go buy some other real estate and so forth. You don't steal it. Now, they did buy some, to be fair. There were infusions of cash from the Rothschilds to buy properties from the Palestinians or the Arabs. And but then when it, you know, when they used terror to remove the rest.
Just for clarity, though, because people often think that when you say Zionists, you're only referring to Jews. I mean, in America, no. I think around 70 million Zionists are those evangelical Christians.
Yes. So we make this very clear. Okay, there's three things. Not all Zionists are Jewish. Not all Jews are Zionists. But then there's a third thing. Zionism benefits Zionist Jews.
Yeah.
That's who it's for. Okay. So the other people, the Gentiles, the Christian Zionists, they're serving the agenda of the Zionist Jews.
And that's through indoctrination, through their own doctrine.
Cult. Yes, through their own religious doctrine or cult. It's the whole Christian Zionist theology, if you want to call it that, political theology is really what it is, was a Zionist psyop to begin with.
Yeah, Darby, Schofield, etc.
Schofield, etc. Yeah, Schofield Bible. Mm. Untermeyer being the main liaison between the Rothschild and the Rothschilds and Schofield. And so forth, yeah.
I mean, you said earlier that you'd like to remove Zionism from the U.S. government.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's probably the starting point, but yeah. It seems impossible.
It's a Herculean task, but the options are basically two others. One, to effectively lay down and let it happen. To be bulldozed over like Rachel Corrie. I'm not saying she let that happen, but, you know, to be bulldozed like Rachel Corrie or armed revolution, and that's not going to happen because it's just not going to happen. So, and because people say, well, you can't vote your way out of this. Well, what is your proposal? That's what I'd like to know. If you can't vote, you're saying we can't do anything politically. We can't vote our way out of it. So what's your proposal? They don't come up with one. It's typically, they just allude to this idea that there's some other way, but tell me what it is. And they don't really have an answer. So I think that we're using electoral means. This is purely peaceful, using the electoral system and the following the Constitution of the United States, nothing illegal, nothing violent, to remove these people from office through electoral means. We're not talking about hopping and physical removal by extracting them and throwing them out of the country. We're talking about voting them out of office. It is even
the problem
that.
Is,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but the problem is that you won't have any government.
Well, we'd have to replace most of the people. True. But we're just trying to get a block in right now in the midterm. So we're trying to get a block, a small block, if we will, of anti-Zionists who are going to make an be obstreperous, to be obstructionist in there. And then hopefully that block grows over time. And we'll work to make that block grow over time.
Well, I mean, Catherine Austin Fitz likes to say you change the world one person at a time.
Yeah, that's right. So in the case of people that won't change their ideology, we'll just have to get rid of them. not physically. Okay, I got to be careful. Look, next time, you know, they're going to call me Hitler too or something. I'm saying this is purely through a legal electoral process. And if they won't change their views, and we try to work on that too, on that end, to try to change the views of people that already are in office. Now, there's other lobbies that are trying to do that part too, pro-Palestinian lobbies, things like that. And we're working with some of these. But we have a different approach in the sense that we think, and leftist anti-Zionism has made has been ineffective, let's be real. It's been ineffective because it's approaching the problem from the wrong side. It's trying to elect Democrats into office, in some cases in really Republican strongholds, and that'll never happen. So what our approach is to get Republicans to go after the Republican side of it, to replace the Republicans with other Republicans who are non or anti-Zionist.
Because you're up against basically the whole MAGA cult also.
Well, they're falling apart, though. MAGA is breaking up because of this issue. MAGA is divided. It's fractured. I'd say there's a huge disaffection amongst the MAGA crowd over this particular issue itself. Many people see the writing on the wall. It's like, what is this? Is this the United States of Israel or what? And they see if those who really fall, you know, we're MAGA because of the America First principles that Trump espoused and then utterly betrayed, then they're going to be disaffected. They're going to be disaffected MAGA people. There are some other types, of course, that are loyal to Trump no matter what he does, and that's just a cult. But there are non-cult members amongst MAGA, and they're peeling off.
And you can also see some pretty big commentators starting to swing. I mean, Charlie Kirk was, I think, on the verge of turning.
Yeah. Yes, he was. I think he was he was turning, and he was beginning to turn. And I mean, he said straight up, I can, in a text message that's been publicized, he said, I have no other option but no longer support Israel.
Mm. And you can see this with Candace Owens. That was her big thing with Ben Shapiro, and they kind of split up. And now you can see Tucker Carlson is also starting to question things.
Oh yeah, Tucker Carlson's been very strong on this, and they named him the anti-Semite of the year last year, which is ludicrous. I mean, they even had Miss Rachel in that contest, you know, this group called Stop Anti-Semitism. I really find these kind of things. Don't these people realize that when you try to like stop something, you produce it. You end up producing it because people hate you for trying to control their behavior and their speech.
Well, I mean, all that you have to do is when somebody calls you anti-Semitic, you respond by saying, I'm not anti-Semitic. I've got nothing against Arabs.
That's right. That's a good one. That's very good. Yeah. Very good because, you know, the Palestinians are Semites, okay? And they're slaughtering. They're the ones. I'd say Israel is the biggest anti-Semitic entity on earth. And they produce anti-Semitism on purpose, I believe. Because they conflate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism on purpose in order to say that any opposition to what they're doing is anti-Semitic. And that's a total ruse. It's a complete sham. I mean, it's a trick. And a lot of people fall for it.
What would you say then is the moral of the story here?
Yeah, that's a great question. The moral of the story is we're fighting for our freedom, and we have to acknowledge the obstacles to that freedom and remove those obstacles. We have to fight against those obstacles and whatever they are. For example, if China was running the United States, I would be I would have founded an anti-CCP PAC. Okay. But it's not China running the country. So you have to identify the obstacles to liberty and attempt to remove those obstacles. And the true value has got to be freedom and self-determination and individual sovereignty.
The great reject.
Exactly. The great no.
Yeah. Okay, Michael, how can I follow you?
Well, on X is really where I'm the most rambunctious, I should say. That's at Wreck the Regime, at REC the Regime. And then my personal website is michaelrechtenwald.com. I also have a Substack. You just search for R-E-K-T, Wrecked. Michael Rechtenwald, Wrecked. And then our website for the PAC is aza-pac.com. aza-pac.com.
And you've also got a few books, going back to Snowflakes and Wokeness, and now about the Great Reset.
I have 14 books now. I just published another academic book called Authority and Contest, Periodicals on British Knowledge Politics, 1820 to 1860. And then before that was the Great Reset. Yeah, so I continue. I don't know how many more I have left, but I still think there's a few books left in me.
And they're all novels.
And, there's two novels. There's the Thought Criminal novel, and then there's the Cabal Question novel, which is another. That came in between after the Great Reset book.
All right, Michael Rechtenwald. Let me try that again. Michael Rechtenwald, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you.